Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. I hate proving that it is now or never. And so, and I do it enough, I think, that you can just go back and listen to any of my podcasts. As a matter of fact, I think I even notate when I really go down a rat hole on just how now or never it really is. But anyway, what I want to do today, and actually it's Feedback Friday. What I want to do is I want to dig into the feedback I got. And I mentioned this on Monday. The feedback I ended up getting on Friday evening, and I'll give you the details on that because this is really regarding the Wyoming call we had, and I will just say feedback that I got in the call regarding counties and the paradigm. I think what's really important is people understand that there is a paradigm out there that is creeping into the lives of many people, and it is the accepting of government handouts and the acceptance of government basically being the teat for society. And there are people in the conservative ranks that are alarmingly either unaware or they've stepped into that sandbox, and they're in the midst of actually going and playing in the sandbox, and I think they're they're getting lost, and I don't have a good story to give you, but it is the sign of the times, and so we'll get into that. But first, there's a few other things we need to do. First off, we're going to get into the monetary thing, but I wanted to remind you that if you're looking to get gold and silver, the best price that I know of, now, there may be other ways of getting it, and if you want to get smaller amounts, and oh, by the way, you can go down the path of getting silver rounds instead of liberties, because there's such a shortage of silver liberty dollars that you're paying 40%, and it's going to only get worse and go up. And that's just, but that's not the same with gold. And there are 1/10 ounce gold coins out there that are worth, you know, $300-$400. I think the Fed is selling them, or the U.S. Mint is selling them somewhere around $350 to $400. And you can get them for, I think, two something. So there's a good correlation between what you're paying for it and what gold spot is. Now, in contrast, we'll go into the differences between gold spot and what you're paying for a gold coin, and we'll get into that as well. But go to Monex and set yourself up. Go, and actually, the information is on the Take Action page. So if you want to go and set yourself up a referral account, then contact the gentleman on that I have on there, the phone number information. Contact him. Just say GR sent you. And even if you're not buying, even if you're not buying any gold or silver, you're not planning on it, but you know a lot of people that will, and you can refer them. And what will end up happening is that he'll at least understand that, you know, the source of this show is driving market to them. They don't actually advertise, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to see if they could actually become a sponsor, not of Reclaiming the Republic, but of your work in trying to get your, I'll just say, getting your counties and getting your states on constitutional track, because that's what we need to start doing, is we need to start actually bringing businesses on board to actually start funding. They have to recognize that they are in the midst of losing their entire trade and their entire business. I'm going to tell you that gold is, you know, they may actually allow it to be sold and so forth, but they will look at these commodity exchanges as problematic because, bottom line, folks, you're going to be able to, if you have the money, if you have the wealth somehow that you can actually create, and there'll be people that will be feeding into, because just imagine, there'll be people that will actually go into the digital currency and actually be able to use that digital currency to buy gold because they'll have access to that. And they will be able to buy that gold and silver and bypass by selling these things in a black market. And so that in that way, I can't see how the government can allow this. So look at China. Does China allow a former currency other than the yuan to be, you know, sold and put out there? Because when we go away from the dollar and we go away from the metal currency that we're constitutionally supposed to have this, then they have to go after and close that market down. This is going to be huge, and it'll be a global shift. And what they're going to do to force people or just to entice people, you know, all that money you got in your IRA, all that money you've got in these savings, all that money is going to be worthless, or it's going to be pennies on the dollar. If you want to get a dollar for dollar transfer, you got until this amount of time to, you know, put that into your digital currency account. And if you don't do that, then it's all gone. Or they won't let you do it. It'll be trapped over there, and it'll only be worth pennies on the dollar. And slowly, as they start severing the system, then they will actually go after and close down and make cash illegal, gold exchanges, and those types of things. Now, we have inalienable rights here, folks, but they don't care. They don't even care about your right to petition. This is being proven more and more and more. This is why we have to exercise the right of petition and let everybody know this is the last fundamental right that we actually have. And it is the strongest right that we have in fighting back and getting government into line and holding them accountable, especially your public servants, as we know. We're still covering the content, or the Massachusetts debate is still the primary content, and we'll be doing that into this coming week. And I believe Paul will be with me all week this coming week. I don't see any reason why not, but you never know. Dynamics happen and things happen, but I think it's always better when Paul's there, Paul's involved, especially in reading the content. But anywho, okay, so let me dive into the Monex, and I should say the gold situation. The week before, so what I'm doing is, because it's really hard for me to track week by week, unless I had the time to actually sit down and create a daily spreadsheet of when the market closed, what was spot, and what was the cost of the silver dollar. I'm just saying that they're not trending, or they're not actually, you know, keeping track of all of this. So capturing that, you may be able to capture it on a graph, but it's just not the best way to go about doing this. So what I'm doing is I'm basically giving you what the spot price. Now remember, the spot price of silver at $20, it was going for like $31. So it was 40% more, plus over 40% markup from spot to the silver dollar, to the silver Liberty. Now, this is why I'm going to tell you that you can buy silver rounds. In other words, these are 1 ounce silver. They look like a silver dollar, but they're just not a US dollar. It's a 1 ounce silver round. It's equivalent in the value of silver to a dollar, but it is not minted as a dollar. So you can buy these things, and I've talked to a few people that do this, and I don't want to give you bad advice to say you shouldn't do this, but I will say this, that the reason I recommend the Liberty Dollars and actually U.S. minted coin is because when somebody holds that, they recognize that mint. I mean, they can look at it and they go, wow, okay, this is a real gold or silver dollar, whatever the metal is. And so when you hand somebody a silver round, they could say, well, this looks like just a plug. How do I know this is pure silver? So if you go down that path, you may want to actually get yourself a little measurement kit, because there are mechanisms like the displacement of water or the ounces and displacement and so forth that you can use. How can you prove that that is really 1 ounce of silver? Because in the old days, they actually had that. It wasn't a matter of just using a scale, but it was a scale and displacement, because you understand the properties that 1 ounce would displace a certain amount of water. If it was silver, if it was iron, it was different. If it was, let's just say, coke, or let's just say, and I mean coke, the ore, the metal, every metal has its own properties and it has its own weight. And so it will displace a certain amount of water. So if it is pure, as one would attest, then we would know exactly how much the displacement is. Anyway, so gold on the day or the week before FedNow. So this is basically, I think, the 7th or the 8th of March, the week before FedNow. Gold was 1814. Now it's a 2020. So I'm going to keep on giving you the 1814, the week before FedNow. And now it's gone up to 2020. Silver was $20. Now it's $25.75. 2007 to $25.75. So put that, you know, in your pipe and kind of puff on that. And you start understanding that this is only, what, a month and a half into FedNow or before the opening. And once FedNow opens, I think most everybody's going to start realizing, what is this? Because the only people I know of that have heard of FedNow are patriots. And I'm going to just say, so out of all the patriots, and I'm just going to guess that, you know, the patriots may be 1%, maybe 1%, to 2%. And I would say that the people that are in the patriot milieu, but not patriots, but I mean, you know, they consider themselves conservatives. The conservatives, I would probably say, is about 10%. So there may be 10% of America that understands the FedNow was stood up, but out of that 10%, many of them don't understand the ramifications, or they don't believe it yet. And so there hasn't been that big of a, you know, surge in the taking, because what's going to happen is these coins that have been minted that are in circulation are going to be removed, because the demand will go up. What ends up happening is the price goes up, maybe not the price of silver, but the price of the commodity, the silver dollar, the gold, you know, Liberty dollar, maybe even the Monex silver round, if they only have so many. Now, the question is, you know, how well will Monex be able to continue minting their rounds? So there may be a point in time when the best thing you can get and the only thing you can get are the rounds. I would highly recommend you investigate and look at the rounds as an alternate, just to be able to make sure you're getting one more for your money, first off, because it's 40% less in paying for this. Because I think right now, if the spot is 25 and you add 40% on that, now, and actually I could actually go real quick, because I'll give you the current price on a silver dollar while we're sitting here. And oh, by the way, I am actually going to be providing you with a little bit of music as I go cover one of the things, or one of the need to know news topics, or things that you really want to understand what the heck's going on, and try to place some context to this, because I'm hoping that you actually kind of see both the sardonic tone or the sarcasm that I have, as well as this is a reality. You know, this is a religious reality for folks. Now, right now, we're looking at the cost of a silver Liberty on Monex is around, and I'm going to guess, what is the best price for it? They usually have it up top. $37.86. So it's $25. So it is 12, if you buy 100, it's 1200, but it's basically $12, over $12. on top of the 27. So if you do the math on that, that's, folks, it's over 40%. Gold is cheaper, but gold rounds and silver rounds are at spot, are very close to spot. So consider getting yourself the mechanism to be able to prove to people, you know, with a little guide or what have you, because you may be in a situation where you really only have rounds or what have you. That person's going, how do I know this is real? And then you can actually show them, you know, the methodology of how to measure and prove the value or the amount of silver in a metal or what have you. And that way you can actually, you know, utilize those rounds as a currency, utilizing silver as a currency. And as a matter of fact, I got this information from the show host Thumper at Patriot Soapbox 24/7, something like that. Anyway, I forget the name of the channel, but it's a, I think it's, they used to be a YouTube channel, but you'll have to actually Google them or DuckDuckGo them to find them. It's Patriot Soapbox 24/7. They literally have commentators that go 24/7 around the clock and talking about what's going on. They have chat and all of that. And they have quite a few followers. So anyway, the next thing we really want to cover or, you know, dive into is AM radio. I'm not sure if you understand this, but they are actually trying to take and make sure that cars coming out no longer have AM radios. What this means is, and I just want you to understand, where do you get most of your conservative content? Where does the conservative content ride? Well, some people get it on satellite, but most of America gets their content of conservative news, conservative information, you know, all their conservative entertainers are where? It's out in the AM stratosphere. In other words, if they take AM radio away, because how many people listen to AM in their home? How many people listen to AM in their at work or wherever, you know, when they're not in their car? And they know that if they actually take away AM radio and silence that, and they've already kind of been doing this because more and more cars are not coming with radio, but they're actually putting their sights in to say, you know, we want to eliminate this. We want to eliminate this medium. Folks, I've already told you, and I told you about 2 years ago about how you could monetize this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic, by really revitalizing AM radio in your area. So what does this mean? This means that having an AM radio, a portable or what have you, may be a pretty important way for you to receive information, because it doesn't, just so you understand, radio stations themselves, especially AM radio, it is not that expensive to operate. Ask Alan Gottlieb, the founder of the Second Amendment Society, or the Second Amendment Foundation, SAF. He actually owns and operates, I think, 5 or 6 AM radios in the Pacific Northwest. And it's, you know, doing that is pretty expensive. But when I look at some of these really rural areas, they have some really, I mean, they have radios out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm here to tell you that I'm tongue-tying myself. The majority of the urban and ultra-rural areas, the majority of these spaces really do rely on AM radio. And if they make these things disappear over time, then AM radio loses its relevance and people just won't be able to operate anymore. One of the costs of AM, the biggest cost of AM, as I understand it, besides the facilities, besides, you know, the antenna, the facilities it takes, you don't have to have a big office. You know, you can have a little shack next to your antenna or, you know, a ways away from your antenna. But the other than the physical cost, your monthly cost is the electricity it takes to transmit. And with the price of electricity, the lack of revenue coming down to where these guys aren't making as much money. And this is why, if you go back and listen, I haven't done one on monetizing the radio. So I need to do that. I need to actually do another radio or podcast or show on how important it is by monetizing Reclaiming the Republic so that you can actually provide the information to your community in what you're doing. So this is kind of important, and I don't expose this to everybody because you got to build a base. You have to have a movement going before you can actually go to the radio station and say, look, we've got a movement going. You need to pipe this information in. This is the truth. So one of the things I actually want to share, because we're going into the break in about 4 minutes. We had a call on, it was last night. I'm sorry. So we had a Montana call, and we had a pretty decent turnout, and it was our second call, and I did a monologue, and then we started talking, and people started expressing their frustrations with their county commissioners, just like I'm getting from Wyoming, just like you're going to get when you start dealing with your county commissioners. We're going to dive into that when we come back after the break. I got to wrap this up. So bottom line, in this phone call or in this meeting last night, there was actually a state legislator that, you know, piped up. And it was, you know, you get that just rush or that warm feeling in your, you know, in your chest that, you know, it's a validation. And when I heard this representative actually say, what is going on here is exactly what needs to be done. And he piped in at that point right after I basically said, look, our representatives at the state and at the county, you know, we can't blame them if we are not doing what we need to do. We need to give them the petitions. If you watch that video, or the two videos, and when I do the other follow-up videos for the county commissioners, I want you to actually watch that and understand that we, the people, have our equal share of the blame. If we're not holding government accountable, then it's hard for them to actually hold themselves accountable. It's hard for a county commissioner or all of your county commissioners to go up to the state house and say, you've got to do these things because we want you to. It's a lot easier for them to say, we've got these petitions and we need you to wake up because the people are waking up. The petitions are this is the ammo. Every petition is like a bullet shot at your politicians. It's not a fatal bullet, but it is letting them know that they are, you know, we're in desperate shape here, and they need to act on these very specific issues. So with that, the last thing I really want to cover is kind of like, and I'll just say this, in the spirit of the Tide podcast, the CIA has kind of introduced what I would call a challenge similar to that. And it has become a real religious thing. And I'm going to play a little music in the background. I'm trying to do this so that you can kind of get this along with what I'm trying to tell you. This is a gospel song, but listen to the words that they're using here. Yeah. Who's going to save the planet? It's literally a gospel song about saving the planet. And this song goes all the way back to the late 60s when the environmental movement was going on. If you haven't noticed the drive in trying to get people to start eating bugs and the drive in trying to get people to, you know, actually go, you know, and plant gardens for climate change. I mean, they're advertising these ludicrous things all for climate change. People are going to be sucking this stuff up. Folks, if you start eating bugs, the parasites in there will likely cause all sorts of problems and possibly kill you. Do not start eating bugs and tell your kids that that is a very dangerous play because that's how we die from pestilence. Anyway, this gets into the biblical side of this. So with that, as you can tell, we've kind of ran into the end of the climate or into this segment. And so climate. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to get into the county matters. And I'll tell you, it's kind of difficult running music in the background while I'm doing it because I'm doing this all myself. It's not like I have a little engineer over there like a lot of your favorite conservative entertainers. But I want to make it so that, you know, it is entertaining. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so why do counties really matter, and what the heck happened? You know, why are counties even in this situation, or I should say, why is it that your county commissioners just are no longer respondent? So in the nutshell, or, you know, in a nutshell, I should say, the Supreme Court stepped in the 60s as all a part of the progressive. So there were three big waves, actually, three. The early wave was at the turn of the 20th century. In other words, Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson actually kind of created the first wave of progressivism where government really went down the wrong tracks. And so how we got onto that was invoked by the Fabians, and the Fabian Society, the communists that came here and basically penetrated and infiltrated and took over our education system. There were a bunch of educators from England that were communists that came here and said, now we're going to get ready to go and start converting America. You got to understand that Britain was behind the Organic Act. Britain has been behind all of these things. And this has all been basically put in motion to ultimately end our constitutional experiment and end individual liberty and individual sovereignty on the earth. In other words, that book I have on my website, The Proof of a Conspiracy to Destroy All Governments and All Religions of Europe, was actually a conspiracy to do the same over the world. And many of these nations have fell. And as a matter of fact, they already have taken over these Bolshevik revolutions and the communist revolutions, as the domino theory has proven, boom, 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 boom. And most people thought, well, that can't happen here. It's been happening here. As a matter of fact, it has been happening since the 1800s, the late 1800s, when the Fabians started teaching communist economics and, you know, those types of concepts, statism and state power. Teddy Roosevelt was really upset. I shouldn't say really upset, but he was disappointed that he wasn't in at Harvard at the time when they were teaching these things, because he thought he would have been far better off had they came to America like 5 or 6 years earlier while he was at Harvard. Then he would have had the exposure to this, and he thought, well, you know, he would know more of how to implement it. Anyway, as we start looking at how many people were infiltrated. And I'm here to tell you, if Teddy Roosevelt liked the idea of statism and liked the economic theory that was being put into, you know, American economics, which was basically the Marxism and Keynesism, or Keynes economics, because there was a contrast. I don't want to dive down this path. So let me pull out of this rat hole really quick. There have been lots of different people that have put different spins on state-controlled economics. And so Milton Friedman, Ludwig von Mises, and Hayek, and there were many brilliant minds that kept on defending a free market and the capitalist system. Anyway, the fact is that in the 60s, they had finally advanced to a point where the courts had already been subdued and had been taken over. And that actually happened when FDR basically threatened the court, and there were already players on the court at that time that were ready to actually start taking advances. And one of those, the key player, the key progressive, the key communist, or I should say the key evil man, was Hugo Black. Hugo Black was a 33-degree Mason, and he actually was the one that injected separate but equal policies in the government. He was the one that injected a lot of social justice paradigms into the justice system and into American politics. So by the time we hit the 60s, which was the third wave, because FDR was the second, there was this little lull between Harding and Coolidge. There was not a lull because socialism ramped up with Hoover. Hoover was a Democrat that ran on a Republican ticket, and he was the one that gave us the New Deal. And so when we really look at the progressive era, it's not like we had a lull. I just think that Truman was oblivious. He really didn't understand what needed to be done, and Eisenhower didn't understand probably what needed to be done. So they were more puppets, because the progressive era kept going, and it got a huge awakening and a huge surge when Lyndon B. Johnson actually took over the presidency. John F. Kennedy was a problem because he was not going along with the program. And so some can say he was assassinated for that particular reason. It's hard to tie the evidence, but I believe that some of that evidence has already been revealed that you can start connecting the dots. Bottom line, and I'm not asking you to believe all of this, but I will tell you what you can believe is when you look at, I believe the cases were Reynolds v. Sims and what was it, Carr something. So I will find out that, you know, I'll dive through here really quick and come to the cases in this document that I have. How hard is it to remember that there were two cases? There it is. Baker v. Carr in 1962. And Reynolds v. Sims in 1964, and then there were a couple of other cases. But what these cases did was they introduced a policy that was unconstitutional. They manufactured social justice by instituting this principle called one person, one vote. And this one person, one vote was the whole intent behind this wasn't to ensure a person had the ability to vote for their representative. It was making sure that they had more power in voting for the people that would do the bidding, or this enabled and empowered the progressive government to actually start taking over with gerrymandering by using population. So here's the thing. Remember Eisenhower told us, be very watchful of this industrial warfare complex, this military industrial complex. And with a sleight of hand, prior to him even telling us this, he actually established with an executive order the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And what he did was he instituted the destructive programs of government welfare that would create enable the entitlement state that would actually throw us into the arms of socialism. While he got everybody looking and going, oh no, this warfare thing, that's terrible. While they actually built the socialist machine right here underneath our feet and got people to start buying into it. You know, in the 50s and the early 60s, and as a matter of fact, there's a really good book, My Struggle Against the Fight Against Equal or something like that, Ward Connerly. Look up Ward Connerly and look at the books, because right now I can't think of all these things. I just have not had a lot of sleep over the past week. So the reason why I'm a little tongue-tied is because of that. But anyway, look up that book and read that book, his struggle against the, you know, the fight for equality or what have you, because it wasn't about equality. It was about basically enslavement. And so Ward Connerly talks about the black community, being a black man. He talked about the black community in the 50s and how his mother, you know, actually was an ardent opponent against social welfare. She wouldn't take it. Then finally, when they moved to California and she was a single mom, there was a pastor that was in the home convincing her to get onto the welfare program. And this was in the 60s. And this was Ward Connerly and his mom. He goes, "Mom," and that's, I think, when he moved out. But it's a great book that you need to read, because what he's showing is how the black community was sold out by their pastors. And I hate to say this, but these men were all co-opted by this. And I'll just say it this way. When you look at what drives a pastor is the money he makes. And most of the pastors that we're talking about were those who, you know, were in front of impoverished flocks. I mean, at that point in time, because of the civil rights and all these other problems, the Christian religion that was being in these communities was equally struggling. Or I should say the pastors were equally struggling. So what was in it for them? If they got their parishioners and the members of their flock to actually get onto the welfare program, some of that money would trickle into his pocket. And so as that money started coming in, boom. And this is how, and this was the beginning. This literally was the beginning of the circle of protection. They don't tell you this, and they don't show you and connect the dots, but it was all about infiltrating religion in making sure that people were, you know, on the take and getting people, as many people, dependent on government and government programs to enslave them. These people, the pastors, they didn't care. Why? Because it meant more money for them. Hey, something's in it for me. I'm going to do this. Folks, this is where we're at with these county issues. So in this meeting, and I kind of told you about this earlier, that I got pushback from a former legislator that was in this call. And I did not record the call. I'm really kicking myself, but I can actually speak a little more freely regarding the issues of this call because you can't listen to it. So anyway, as I started talking, and this is what distracted me, because we hadn't started the meeting, but, you know, I kind of allow conversations to begin. And before you know it, we start getting engaged in, I'll just say, a wrestling of ideologies and talking about what we need to do and, you know, or helping people understand these things. And I get distracted and I forget to even hit that record. You know, the only reason I'm able to do radio shows is because before I even start talking, I hit the record and I'm able to edit all this, you know, the dead silence and all that stuff. Anyway, the issue that we were struggling on was this legislator said that the county is not an elected representative body. It is really an administrative arm of the state government. And so I said, that's not true. They are elected and they take an oath to support the Constitution. And so they are legally bound to support the Constitution. They go, no, statutes are basically created that actually define them and what they need to do. Well, so this actually caused me to do a lot of research and writing this article called Why Counties Matter. This is where I kind of identify. There are a couple of other cases, but Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims are the two key ones. And if you look at these cases, what these cases did was they destroyed American republicanism in the states because they basically wiped away the county governments. And as they did that and they reallocated the apportionment for the House of Representatives as well as the apportionment for the state Senate, the House of Representatives for the state legislature, then what they did was they got a democracy invoked into the state legislature. and they took away the suffrage of the county. Now, see, here's the problem. When we created these constitutions, the one thing that nobody picked up and one thing that nobody understood was you needed to protect the suffrage of the county. When I mean the county, not the people, but those like governors, the state legislature, the county legislature, they have to be protected to make sure that they will always maintain equal suffrage in the Senate, just like the U.S. Constitution. And this is where people kind of give me this look and they say, what are you talking about? There's no guarantee for equal suffrage in the Senate for the states. And I turn them to Article 5. The last part of Article 5 is the Amendment Protection Clause that ensures that no amendment can be passed that will remove a state's suffrage without their consent. And and I can actually get into that, but this article kind of goes through all of this. This article actually goes through, you know, the essence of the creation of states. We've already talked about this. And when we get into the Enabling Acts, what I'm going to do is I'll be able to show you. See, the very first few states, it was a no-brainer. Kentucky, Vermont. Vermont, Kentucky, Tennessee, all the way up to Louisiana. I think Louisiana was the sixth state to join the Union, fifth or sixth. And the reason it jumped ahead of everybody is because it was already mature and developed by Spain and the French. I mean, Spain did it, and then the French ended up owning it, and this is how it fell into our laps through the Louisiana Purchase with Thomas Jefferson. And this is why the state was erected rather quickly, because New Orleans and that whole area already had a major population. So they could easily, and they were quickly brought into the Union. By doing that, the Congress kind of actually took a gut punch. Because when Louisiana came into the Union, they didn't make common law the law of the state, nor did they have the necessary components of counties, because counties were government operated. In other words, people instituted government in a representative government for governing the people of that land or that area of the county. Well, in Louisiana, they had parishes, and parishes were governed by the Catholic Church, which was problematic. And so they had to, you know, kind of say, okay, now you have to have, you know, a parish government, and we're not allowing the church to control the state. But they couldn't say that. They couldn't say that. So in all enabling acts that preceded that, that followed that Enabling Act of Louisiana, because if you read the Enabling Act of Louisiana, you know, they just basically followed the same program that they did with the previous states. It did grow. The Enabling Acts and the language of them actually did grow. When you see Vermont, Kentucky, Tennessee, and so forth, you go, oh my. But the next state to join the Union was Indiana. And in the Enabling Act, this is the first time Congress actually specified that the counties needed to be formed, the counties, once they're formed, they need to establish delegates. So the territory, and as a matter of fact, the federal government at this point in time was controlling all the territories now. Louisiana was kind of unique. And so I can't tell you enough how Louisiana was so problematic that when it came into the Union in 1812, just less than 10 years later, I mean, they were mature enough. And the only reason that it took that long was, you know, we actually had to get out there, survey the Lewis and Clark stuff, and they wanted to make sure they had the boundaries. I mean, the things that were necessary to actually bring this in. And so when they created Louisiana, and again, like I said, they really rued the day. It was a gut punch to them. They learned that they needed to specify that counties would form delegates that would actually go and create their constitution and create their government. So it was a government that was instituted by men. What does our Declaration say? when we look at the Declaration, you know, everybody kind of understands this, but I think most people kind of forget this, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, everybody remembers that. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted by men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Most people say that, and they, you know, it's just kind of automatic to say, but they forget what that means, that we actually have to create that county government. And when the county government was created by the church, or the parish government was kind of created by the church, then it's not the same thing. So Louisiana really kind of, you know, threw a real curveball in the makeup of the United States, and it created a frustration of a lack of common law. And as you understand, the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states, so the Bill of Rights and common law, like its suits in common law of the Seventh Amendment, that wasn't applicable. And when the 14th Amendment finally passed, the 14th Amendment basically should have, and the federal government should have gone to Louisiana and said, look, you now have to implement common law, and you now have to start, you know, giving your citizens these protections, because we've now applied the Bill of Rights with the 14th Amendment to you to protect the citizens' privileges and immunities. So anyway, as I go through this document, I really lay out how the framers created a new form of republicanism, and in this contract, in this compact, this design of a republican form of government was unlike any other, that we actually, and I go through this all the time, that the representation is of the sovereigns. It's not just we the people. We the people have our representation and suffrage. When we vote for somebody to go to the House of Representatives, they are our representative in voting for us on issues that are in pursuant to the Constitution. They should have no voting. They should have no involvement in anything to affect us that is not enumerated. This is a huge difference, and we go through this a lot too. The enumerations of our Constitution are supposed to constrain and basically den or contain our government into very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties. So as we kind of go through this article, I kind of lay out this design, this republican form of government, that the counties and the states are equal entities with sovereignty. When we create our county, when we create our state, we give them specific powers. And so the problem is that we've never gone down the path of creating constitutions. As I understand it, there are states in this union that have done that, that the people have actually set up their own delegates and actually formed that constitution. That's something that needs to happen, where the majority of the people actually form and sit down and write a constitution that will go in effect. That constitution goes in effect when the new state constitution goes into effect, because this is a constitutional push in trying to get everything realigned back under this limited government concept, this limited government design that the framers had, and ensure that our county government and our state government are aligned in such that we will maintain our individual liberty and individual sovereignty. Well, so here's the interesting thing. When I started discovering, and I went down this discovery path over the past week, looking at how was Wyoming formed, how was it formed, and they didn't have an enabling act. Just so you know, they actually just took it upon themselves to form. So what they did was the governor of the territory basically identified how many delegates for each of the counties, called the counties into Cheyenne to basically create the constitution and create and form the government. So as they did this, you know, we start looking at what they did and how they formed it. And in the Constitution, or in the Constitutional Convention, Laramie had 11 delegates, Albany had 8. So there's these 10 counties, and they had like, you know, 50, 60 delegates that created their government. And then once they created their government, they actually created an apportionment. And this is how they apportion for their representatives in the state house. That each county shall constitute, this is a quote, each county shall constitute a senatorial and representative district. The Senate and House of Representatives shall be composed of members elected by the legal voters of the counties respectively. Every 2 years, they shall be apportioned among the said counties as nearly as may be according to the number of the inhabitants. Each county shall have at least one senator and one representative. So they were at least trying to guarantee and ensure that there were suffrage and representation in the state house for each county. And then when the Reynolds v. Sims and and the other case came out, when those cases came forward out of the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court basically did was he said, we do not care about your Republican form of government. We are instituting a new Democratic Republican form of government where the people and took away the sovereignty of the counties. This is why counties matter. This is why we actually need to start helping you understand why going into these counties, just be clear, going into these counties, many of them are going to say, we're not supposed to do this because the statutes tell us otherwise. You can actually point to them, the U.S. Constitution and the requirement and the oath of office. And if they're not willing to actually stand up and restore the county government the way it should be, as it was done in the Constitution, because the Supreme Court, folks, does not have any authority to amend the U.S. Constitution, let alone any state constitution. So they may have made a ruling in a particular case, but that ruling does not create law, nor can that law be an amendment to the Constitution, especially if that law that or when they the ruling itself is not in pursuant to the Constitution. One of the things I also need to expose you to, because we got just 1 minute left, the history of all of this, as we look at this, you know, this whole thing, we look at the fact that for decades and centuries, the Supreme Court has failed to actually, they say this Republican form of government is something that we don't have a right to hear. We're not going to, and they've never had a case in ruling on a Republican form of government. However, with a backhand, they actually attacked by using a ruling and destroyed the state's Republican form of government. Is that irony? Is that a paradox? No, this was a part of the social justice program that was necessary in reforming state governments. This is why what you're doing is so critical in putting all the focus at the county. See, I knew we needed to go down here, and I knew we needed to be here, and I knew this information, you know, was out there, but I never actually compiled it together. And so when you start looking, go look at your original constitution under the U.S. Constitution. If you live in one of the 13 states, you have a really old artifact constitution that they created. Look it up. Go out there and get the truth so that you can start showing people how it was actually to be applied and why counties do matter. They're the most significant government in your life. I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution.
We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.